This is Dr. Bill Mounce in his teaching on the Sermon on the Mount. This is session number 2, Beatitudes, part 2.
Okay, let's move on then on down through the Beatitudes and watch the golden chain and watch how all these links come together. God's approval rests on a person who recognizes spiritual poverty, Beatitude 1. And this is a person who recognizes, his spiritual poverty will do what? Will mourn. It's a natural response. You see your depravity and you see, that's a good Calvinist term, Bob. Bob's questioning whether I'm really reformed or not. Depraved person who sees his spiritual poverty, will mourn over his own spiritual bankruptcy. The chain is what keeps the Beatitudes from becoming a list of do's and don'ts. You'll get further down the chain and you'll say, oh, blessed are the merciful, for they shall be shown mercy. Okay, I'm going to just try really hard to show mercy. Can that person do that? No. You can't just kind of start partway through the chain and then say, oh, that's what I'm going to try to do. You've got to start with the spiritual depravity, the spiritual poverty, and then it works its way down the chain. This is what keeps it from becoming a list of do's and don'ts. So what does it mean to mourn? Again, I've already said it. It's to mourn over your spiritual poverty. And mourning is something the church has just forgotten, hasn't it, as the most part. Have you seen Michael Card's book? I guess it's 10 years old now. It's on Lamentations. Michael Card, the singer. It's a really good book on lament. And it's an appeal to bring lament for sins back into the church. And I think you can make the argument, if there is no lament, there's really no recognition of sin. Because if you recognize sin, if you see who you are and who God is, you have to lament, you have to mourn. I mean, it's the only thing that happens. So, I think, yes, for the most part, yeah, that there's when we've moved away from priesthood, we've moved away from the idea of individual lament, but there is corporate lament too. There are corporate lament psalms, and there are simply times that I would say that your church needs to lament over the fact that we murder 3 million unborn babies a year. Or lament over the fact that we as a whole are not countercultural. I understand what you're saying. And there's certainly corporate lament starts with individual lament. But I think there's a place for the corporate too. What does it mean to mourn? I've got three things that when I would preach this, I would cover. Mourning or lament, one, begins with a confession of sin. All you're doing, and encourage you to tell people this, you're just agreeing with God. You're not telling God something he doesn't know. He already knows that you sin. He knows what you did was wrong. And so mourning is simply agreeing with God that he's right and that you're not. So it's mourning starts with a confession of sin. But then secondly, mourning moves from confessing a sin to confessing I am a sinner. In other words, true mourning, true lament moves from an act to character. And even though I am redeemed, I am justified, reconciled, and all these things, and the mastery of sin has been broken. There is still a part of me that just sins. Now, Paul speaking as an incredibly mature Christian, says, it's not me who's sinning, it's sin who sins in me. Which is really a hard thing to preach, right? Unless you're speaking to some very old saints that kind of understand what that means. But the Chinese use WeChat. Do you know that app? It's more for audio texting. And the problem is that the government uses WeChat to gather a lot of data on its people. So you have to be careful with WeChat. But anyway, it's the main way that the Chinese people communicate. And so I got a WeChat from a friend via 2 or 3 days ago. And he said, am I righteous or am I a sinner? And I said, yeah, the way I answer, it was a really an interesting question, because again, the Chinese church is a very guilt-ridden, performance-based kind of culture. I mean, again, broad stroke generality. We absolutely love the Chinese people. That's why I think about them so much and how to help. But this is their challenge. It's one of their main challenges. And I said, well, before conversion, you are a sinner. After conversion, you are righteous, you are redeemed, but you still sin. Mastery of sin has been broken. And he's saying, I'm getting a lot of questions from people who think that after conversion, their basic core nature is still, I am a sinner. And I said, you need to preach sermons on the great doctrines of the faith. You need to teach what justification is and what redemption is and what reconcile. I mean, they need to know that something fundamentally changed who they were. So it's been a very interesting conversation. But again, see, they're just, they fail, so they try harder. And they don't want to say they're righteous because they sin so much. So that's kind of a caveat to what I had written here. I am a sinner. Well, in one level, I'm not, because the mastery of sin has been broken. But in a very real sense, sin is still part of my character, right? So I am redeemed, and I commit acts of sin. But I commit acts of sin because there's still something about my character. So with all that as kind of a theological safeguard, yeah, I am a sinner. Mastery of sin has been broken. It's not just actions I do that are disconnected to my character. They're part of my character still. So you move from committing an act of sin to I am a sinner. And then thirdly, I think true lament moves to I have sinned against God. And I think that's where all lament needs to end. A recognition that even if I do something against Matt, and I'm doing it, I am redeemed and a sinner at the same time, ultimately, my sin is against God. You know the verses. Well, no, except I am righteous. I have He who knew no sin was made to be sin so that I could be made the righteousness of God. So Christ's righteousness has been given to me, whatever the term imputed, I guess, has been imputed into me. And so there, I have been fundamentally changed. I know where you're going with it, but theologically, I am righteous. And so the call is for me to act in accordance with who I am, to learn to act in righteous ways. Is what? Well, I don't think it's a better word, because 2 Corinthians 5 says, the verse I just quoted, I mean, yes, I am redeemed, but God, as John Bunyan says, God looks on me and views me as he views his son, and his son is righteous. And so I have been made the righteousness of God. It's not like God kind of pretends that I'm righteous. I am righteous. I am sanctified. And the call, I mean, that's right. That's biblical teaching. The call of my life then is to act like it. And so you have positional sanctification and experiential sanctification. I am sanctified. It's why Paul can call the Corinthians holy. They call them saints, because they were. They are saints. Now it's time they start acting like it. So their position before God is as a saint, and in experience they are learning what that means. So it's, anyway. Genesis 39:9, how can I do this great wickedness again and sin against God, Joseph says, right? He understands that the sin ultimately, it may have been with Potiphar's wife, but ultimately that sin would go against God. But Psalm 51 is the great one. Against you, this is David's poem, psalm of confession after Nathan confronts him about Bathsheba. Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. Well, I don't know. You impregnated a woman. You murdered her husband. You sinned against a couple of people. But David understands that ultimately all sin goes against God. And in the crying out of his heart, that's what's bothering him the most. Against you, you only have I sinned. So I think when we talk about lament, it's helpful to move that we're dealing with actions, we're dealing with character, and we're dealing with ultimately who we sin against, which is God. There's a million other things if we had time, and we're not. But you know, one of the things when mourning comes up in discussion, the question I ask is: are you sorry that you sinned, or are you sorry that you got caught? So many people, kids. Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay, why are you sorry? You sorry that I got caught? I'm taking your phone away for 2 weeks. Well, that's not sorrow. That's just frustration you get caught. And I just think the American church has lost its sense of the grandeur and the majesty and the awe and the holiness of God. And I long to walk in a Sunday morning gathering where somebody remembers that. And, you know, and this is just me. I have no interest in a pep rally. I no interest in a pep rally. And it seems that so many churches I go to, it's just a pep rally to make me feel good about my sin. I don't know. I'm a little jaded. I just want to be reminded that God's majestic and glorious and I'm not, and that's okay. And just to find a church where there's actually mourning over sin because God is so holy and so, it's so joyful to truly worship God for who He is rather than screaming and yelling and waving happy birthday to Jesus on Christmas. I don't know. Anyway, mourning. Anything you want to say about mourning and my jaded? Oh, I need to finish. I'm sorry. Blessed are those who mourn, that is, mourn over their sin, for they will be comforted. And these are all divine passives, right? The agent of the blessing and all the Beatitudes is God. So the comfort is coming from God. I love the cycle in the scripture of being emptied before you're filled. You've heard that, I'm assuming. It's a way to look at a lot of the ethical teaching of the Bible. It's only those who know mourning, that's the emptying, who will truly be comforted. That's the filling, right? Blessed are those who recognize their poverty of spirit. That's the emptying, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. That's the filling. And so you have this cycle. You have to, Titus 3 in salvation, you were washed and then regenerated. There's the emptying and the filling. And the question is, when does that comfort come? Well, already but not yet, right? It certainly, when you and I confess our sins, when we confess that it's still part of our character and that ultimately our sin is against God, there is comfort that comes. But it's nothing compared to the comfort that's going to come when we stand before the judgment seat and all this is taken away. So we are mourners. We are becoming mourners. And we will ultimately, in this case, get to a point where it's all going to be taken away, which is really cool. I have Revelation 21:4 written down, and I'm not sure why. Let me look it up. You know, I'm so, where's my, I'm so used to using this that I can look up stuff a lot faster than my... I'm sorry? Oh, that's the wipe away. Okay, yeah. Let me... Aren't electronic Bibles amazing? I still, when I study, I want paper. But boy, I mean, just to have your whole library right here. And I'm really curious. How many Logos users? Interesting. Accordance? One, okay. What? Bible Works? Bible Gateway. Bible Gateway.
Yeah.
You use Bible Gateway?
Yes, sir.
Cool. All right. You, yeah, yeah. I like being able to carry it with me. I worked for Bible Gateway for a year, and it was a fascinating year. I learned so much about so many things. But it's you'll notice a very special translation on Bible Gateway. Mine.
Yeah.
All right. 21:4. Oh, sorry. Wrong language. This is a new heavens and new earth are happening. The holy city is coming down. God's dwelling place is now among the people, and He will dwell with them. And I think this is actually the theme that ties the whole Bible together. They will be His people, and God Himself will be with them and be their God. And then here's verse 4. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There'll be no more death, nor mourning, nor crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. So there will be a point at which mourning is no more. And that'll be a great time. And that's when we'll be fully comforted. Okay, any comments or questions on that beatitude? It's one of the things I like about liturgies, and I pastored in a Baptist church, and Baptists don't like liturgies. If I could get them to do responsive reading, I thought that was pretty good. But what they didn't know was I was working with a worship guide to affect liturgies. And kind of regardless of what I would be preaching on, there would be some Sundays where the initial songs were confession of sin, and then songs of thankfulness for forgiveness, which is liturgy. And we would kind of cycle through liturgical themes in the songs that we picked. It's kind of a tricky way to get Baptists to follow a liturgy. But okay. Well, encourage you to find some way to help your people learn to mourn. Okay, we come to the third beatitude in verse 5. Blessed are the meek, for they get nothing in this world and die in misery and shame. That's the new NIV. Did you know? No, sorry. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. So you want to talk about a countercultural statement, right? Because in this world, the meek don't get anything. But in Jesus' economy, in the kingdom of heaven, the meek get everything. They inherit the earth. Meekness. Meekness is a really hard thing to define, isn't it? In fact, it's one of those words where it's almost easier to define what it isn't rather than what it is. Meekness is not timidity, fearfulness, indecisiveness, being unsure, being a wallflower, wishy-washy, or weak. I mean, that's what the world says meekness is. In fact, I'm not aware of any other religion that holds meekness up as a virtue. Now, I don't know all the world's religions, so I may miss one, but I'm not aware of any. So this is kind of a peculiarly Christian quality. It's not those things. I define it, and it's coming out of the books, as two things. It's an attitude and an action, and you got to have both of them together. Remember the golden chain. A meek person is the person who understands his spiritual bankruptcy and therefore has no place for arrogance and pride. In Quarrels, one of the books I asked you to read, which again starts really slow and gets a lot better. I don't know if you found that to be your experience, but yeah, it is good. It's just the way it starts, it's like, oh, I don't want 40 pages on Jesus is the new Moses. You know, get on with it. But anyway, it's good. I don't know how to say his name properly. Does anyone know him? It is Quarles. Quarles, Q-U-A-R. He's the, where is he? Vice president, yeah, in, what school is it? Louisiana College, which I'm assuming is in Louisiana. Anyway, I'm going to say Quarles. Hopefully, I'm saying his name. Although, how would you say it in the Deep South? Quarles? Quarles. Quarles. So, okay, so you soften and lengthen the A, Quarles. I mean, did you go to school with him? Or just another person? Quarles. Okay. And I say, but I'm a Yankee. So I make my vowels all short and harsh.
In the South, vowels are an art.
Yes, they are.
If it's a one-syllable word, it's at least
two. Two, yes.
And if it's two syllables or more, you say it's one syllable.
All right.
If
it's a monosyllable, you say it as two. If it's a polysyllable, you get it into one.
You want to try to say his name monosyllable.
Quarles. Quarles.
See, you're getting there.
Am I getting there? Yeah. All right. Actually, I'm more Southern than probably most of you. My grandpa was born in Gravel Switch, Kentucky. Gravel Switch. They dug a hole in the ground to get gravel out for the railroad, and it became Gravel Switch. And we visited it once. It's in the Appalachians. They're all hillbillies. And it was so strange to drive into town. Everyone was named Mounts. Everyone was named Mounts. And it felt like the Burt Reynolds movie, Deliverance. I don't know. God, do I have to get out of the car? Yeah. And it was fun. And but Grandpa, first day Grandpa ever stepped foot in a school was as a teacher when he was 17. His parents traded chickens with a traveling teacher at a grade to teach him, and he ended up being a professor at University of Chicago. So he did okay. But anyway, so there is some Southern in me that way. I'll claim that. Anyway. Quarles. I can do that. Where on earth am I in my notes? Oh, yeah. A meek person knows a spiritual bankruptcy and therefore has no place for arrogance and pride. What Quarles says is that the emphasis on the word is on submission. And I've not read that elsewhere, but it fits, and I like it. A meek person is a person who, quote, subjects himself to God quietly without resistance. A meek person is a person who knows who God is and knows who he is, because this is the third link in the chain. This is the person that's come to understand his or her spiritual bankruptcy. And it's driven them to mourning. And therefore, because of their understanding, they willingly and gently submit to God without resistance. And in that sense, meekness is much like humility, I think. So meekness is an attitude, willing submission to God. But it's also an action. And a lot of the discussions of meekness in the Bible have to do with how we relate, how we respond to other people. In fact, quite a few of the discussions of meekness are how we respond in the midst of conflict, like 1 Peter 3:14 to 17, that passage. So it's a willingness, submission to God that dictates how we respond to other people. In other words, in the midst of conflict, we don't retaliate. We love, we give, we patiently endure. The verse I go to a lot is Ephesians 4:32, which doesn't use the word meekness, but it gets at the point. I quote the verse and I can't quote it. Be kind, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ has forgiven you. Right? And so it's a recognition, who are we? We're forgiven people. Who's God? He's who forgave us. And therefore, that humility, that submission to God should move us to forgive others, to not retaliate, to not insist on our rights, but rather to forgive. So again, the verse doesn't use the word meekness, but it's a good picture, I think, of a meek person. When I preached through, I got to love Martin Lloyd-Jones' stuff. I don't normally read other sermons. I've heard that preaching is truth through personality. And then on top of that, you add spirit unction on top of it. And you can't replicate what one person does in a pulpit. You just can't. You're a different person, a different set of experiences, different workings of the Spirit, perhaps. And I just find reading other people's sermons really boring. Martin Lloyd-Jones, I was fascinated to read. Just fascinated to read it. In fact, I broke the binding. You know, the current one has it's a single volume paperback. And I broke the binding within a couple of months. And I went to my dad because he had the two-volume paper, hardback. And I about had to beat him up to get those two away from him. So if you ever see Martin Lloyd-Jones's in two volumes on hardback, buy it. Because I've not seen it since I got my dad's. But anyway, I really like Martin Lloyd-Jones. And in preaching through the sermon, there was only one thing that he said that I couldn't make part of my sermon. And it had to do with where I was spiritually and with some conflict in the church. But here's when he talks about meekness, this is how he says. He says it. If a person who is truly meek hears someone criticize them, okay, so you're the pastor, someone's being critical of you, how do you respond? Well, my reaction would be, you know, if you only knew me, you know that's not true. I'm not power hungry. I'm not up here doing that. I mean, I had people we were looking at this thing about having small groups be based on the sermon if they wanted to. But I had one guy in the church that all thought all pastors were inherently evil and power mongers. And I was trying to prove to him that I wasn't going to be an evil power monger. And so, you know, we didn't do that with small groups. And, you know, he would say, Bill, I've known you for all these years, but, you know, you're just really into power. And I wanted to say, if you only really knew me, you'd know that's not true. But Martin Lloyd-Jones says this way, true meekness hears someone's criticize me, and a meek person responds, yes, if you only really knew me, you'd know I'm much worse than you think I am. Now, in good conscience, I couldn't preach it because I wasn't there, and I tried not to preach things that I couldn't say. It's page 57 in the first volume of his book. But that's hard, isn't it? Because, you know, I tell seminarians, be really careful when you go to a church, they're going to put you up on a pedestal. The only reason they're putting you up on a pedestal is to get a clear shot at you. Okay, so be really, really careful. And so, you know, some of my experience is jaded that way. But a truly meek person, because they understand their depravity of sin and are mourned over it, they have a better understanding of who they are and of who God is. And instead of retaliating, they respond in meekness. They respond gently, peacefully. That's the meek person. It's a hard word to define, isn't it? That's the best way I have found to describe it. Meekness is not, I got a quote marks around this, so I may have gotten this from someone. I don't know who. Meekness is not weakness, it's strength under God's control. A meek person, meekest person in the Bible is Moses. Well, okay, Jesus. After Jesus is Moses. You know, not exactly a wuss. Meekness requires a phenomenal amount of strength. It's not being weak. And again, I'm assuming this is Martin Lloyd-Jones's illustration. He says, meekness is the difference between a wild and a tame stallion. Have any of you ridden horses? Not a lot of horse. I'm finding there's not a lot of horse riders around anymore. We had a horse when I was in high school. And it. I remember the first time I sat on a horse, the amount of power was, it was scary is what it was, right? I mean, there's so much muscle. Horses have, each one has its own personality. They're not docile creatures. And you never really know what a horse is going to do. Except a horse will always run under two situations, always. Pointed uphill, it will run and it will die if you don't stop it, right? And it will, when you turn it towards the barn, it runs. And those are the two dangerous times in horse riding because the animal just wants to lunge. A horse will literally run itself to death. So what you have to do with a stallion is that you got to break it, and you break it with a bit, among other things. And so a well-trained horse, as powerful as it is the point of the illustration, as powerful as that animal is, all it takes is a simple moving of the reins, and it turns, right? All it takes is when you're lunging up the hill, you just pull back, and it stops. If it's trained, okay? My horse wasn't trained. But that's what I'm told a trained horse will do. That's a great example of what a meek person is. A meek person is a stallion. It is a phenomenally strong person because you know who you are and you know who Christ is. But you are under His control. And when you are pell-mell running down a direction and God goes, you stop and you turn left, stop and you turn right. That's what a meek person. That's what a trained stallion does. That's what a meek person does. So meekness is strength under God's control. It's not weakness. And they promise the blessing is that they will inherit the earth. Again, a totally countercultural idea because in this world the meek have nothing. And the question, of course, here is what's the earth? Because in this day and age, very rarely do meek people get anything. This is the heavy emphasis is on the not yet, the fulfillment. It is on, we will one day inherit the earth. We will have the new heavens and the new earth. Have you read Randy Alcorn's book on heaven? I really encourage you to. He's got a great big thick one. And I stopped partway through it because I agree with him so much I didn't need any more argumentation. But he's arguing against the position that heaven is a bunch of fat cupids playing harps bouncing off clouds, which isn't in the Bible in any shape, way, or form. He wrote a smaller abridgment of it and really encourage you at least to get that. It's an easy read. It'll give you a feel for it. But Alcorn, I think, properly understands that the new heavens, the new earth are a very physical place. What's in both Genesis 1, 2, 3, and in the end of Revelation? Garden, the river, the tree of life, right? And in heaven, the new heavens and new earth, the tree of life is so big it spans both sides of the giant river and fruit for healing of the nations, and we will eat it and be healed. It's a very physical reality. I was flying, I guess I was flying here, and I was looking out the window, and you could see a bit of the curvature of the earth and the clouds. And when we took off from the Portland airport, there were clouds, and you could see Mount St. Helens, the top of what's left. You could see Rainier, Helens, and Adams. And it was an amazing sight. It was just absolutely gorgeous. And you just, it reminds you, this is God's precious earth. You know the only time Jesus was angry? You know, Jesus was only angry once, as far as we know. Pardon? Doesn't that's what every people think that it never says he was mad. It's when the disciples couldn't cast out the demon, and there's a textual variant, but most likely it says Jesus got angry. There's a related word that means deeply moved, and a lot of people shift to the deeply moved, even though it doesn't have the stronger attestation in the Greek text. Jesus was angry, but he was angry at sin. He wasn't angry at the disciples. He was angry that sin had so messed up his world. And when I was flying here, and I was looking at the curvature of the earth, and I love volcanoes, and I just looking at, and then you come over and you can see all the irrigation circles all the way through central Washington, and you get over there. I mean, I got to see all this, and you go, this is such a precious place. And we were put here to care for it, and we messed it up. Christians should be the greatest ecologists, period, hands down. Don't have to believe in global warming, but we should be the greatest ecologists because this is his world, and we messed it up, so he's going to fix it. And this is the point I'm trying to get to very slowly. Alcorn says, it's a heaven, the new heavens and earth is a physical existence. He thinks there's going to be manufacturing. He even wonders if there's going to be star travel. It's a very physical, what are we going to do for eternity? You can't praise God all the time. But it's a very physical reality. It's the Garden of Eden is what things are supposed to be. And I just was kind of swept over with appreciation for God's earth as I was flying here. I'm going, someday, after you fix it all, we get to live in it and care for it. We get to care for the trees. We get to care for the fish. We get to care for the animals. We got to make sure we don't deforest things again. I mean, we get to care for this place. That's why Alcorn really does not like the song, "This World Is Not My Home, I'm Just Passing Through." He goes, this is home. It's home now. It's going to be home for eternity. So all that to say, it's the meek will inherit the earth. It's going to be an amazing earth that we inherit. And it's going to be all ours to care for. Pretty cool, huh? One of the questions I have, though, in Revelation is to be there's no pain. So if I go rock climbing and break my leg, will it not hurt? I don't know. I think about a lot of silly things. Anyway, all right. Move on to Beatitude number 4, verse 6. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will, their bellies will be filled. All right, some important terms here. What's righteousness? Well, Two parts of it, I think. One is, when you speak about God's righteousness, you're talking about his moral perfection, right? His perfection in his character, his perfection in his behavior. Everything that he is and everything that he does is perfect, morally and in every way. God is righteous. He's the definition of righteous, right? Ultimately, that's why Christians have to come to terms with suffering, because suffering screams that God's not righteous, right? 40,000 children a day die of starvation. God is the definition of what is right, what is morally perfect. I think this is the great conflict for me anyway. I think it's the great conflict for all Christians. Is how do you line up this world with God's righteous character? But I don't know if that's in the Sermon on the Mount, so we'll move on. So righteousness as it pertains to God is his moral perfection in all things, activity and character. Secondly, as pertaining to us, righteousness is us living in conformity with his will. I think that's what Quarles says. Living in conformity to his character, living in conformity to his actions. So, who hungers and thirsts for righteousness? If you preach, you need a hunger and thirst for righteousness. Again, your people will respond, oh great, something else I have to do, right? So, you have to do the chain. Poverty spirit, everything is on that. It drives us to mourning. It makes us understand meekness. But because we have no righteousness of our own, since we're spiritually bankrupt, because we have no righteousness of our own, we desperately desire God's righteousness in our life and in our world. So you can't just start at the fourth beatitude, right? But it is a natural progression from first, second, third to fourth. The first three links of the chain necessarily lead to a, now that you've recognized you are not righteous, you've recognized that God is righteous, you desperately want His righteousness to be in your life. We recognize that we are not right with God and we can never be on our own. It's a desire to be freed from every influence of sin. It's a desire to live a life that is pleasing to God and, in fact, to display God's righteousness. Make sense? One of the greatest changes in my life theologically was when I stopped reading Jesus in the light of Paul. I'd always done that. And when I first went to Gordon Conwell, I requested to teach New Testament survey, and they were happy to give it to me. And I love survey because I can touch more people in the class, in the school than you can if you just teach upper division classes. And I had taught survey a gazillion times at Azusa, and I said, I'm going to try an experiment. I'm going to teach the Gospels as if Paul didn't exist. Okay? And I'm going to let Jesus talk for Jesus. Because in my head, it's always Paul saying, yeah, he talks about poverty of spirit. But Bill, you like justification by faith. So you need to, when we talk about Beatitudes, you need to talk about justification by faith. And I said, I'm going to fight that. I'm going to let the Gospels be the Gospels. And it radically changed how I read the Gospels. Because you'll notice I'm not using Paul hardly at all in defining the Beatitudes. I'm trying to let Jesus. So there's a lot I could pull from about righteousness and pull it from Paul. I'm trying just to stick in the Gospels. All right? And so this is the, because there's obviously a ton of stuff about righteousness in Paul. But I'm trying, how would Jesus' disciples have heard the words? A desire to be, that God is righteousness. God is righteous. He is right in all His moral perfections. I am not. I mourn over it. But I desperately want to be a God kind of person. And I desperately want to live in a world that lives in accordance with God's righteous character and behavior. And that's what this is about. It's hunger and thirst. A deep desire to be right with God. A deep desire to live in that kind of world. This is just a preaching line more than a teaching line. But I said, it doesn't say, blessed are those who nibble and sip on God. It doesn't say, blessed are those who taste Him once at conversion and starve themselves the rest of their life. And I'm just so convinced there are so many people in the church that nibble and sip. And I'm not talking about the people that come to church on Christmas and Easter. I'm talking about the people that view the Christian life as a series of transactions, of unrelated events. And I'm going to do something here, and I'm going to do something here, maybe every other Sunday morning, and I'm going to help park at VBS, and I'm going to do this, and we have this, I always wanted to get a big patchwork quilt and hang it behind me because I use a patchwork quilt as an illustration all the time, is that we've so segmented our lives into little squares. And so many people say, okay, this square is for God, this square is for God. But, you know, what I do on the computer 11 at night on, you know, some porn site, that's no one's business but mine. Or molestation issues. And it just, I love Barna. Do you watch Barna? Do you watch this? I'd really subscribe to Barna's site. They're always coming out with really good statistics that help us understand the church. And I'm going to be quoting quite a few of them. Not to pick on porn, because it is a sin. So is pride and arrogance and all those things. But it said the average evangelical, their poll is, and this is from people that actually answered the poll, the average evangelical pastor intentionally visits a porn site once a week. And I don't know if any of you struggle with it. My guess is some of you do. And I'm not saying this to shame you. I once preached a difficult sermon. When I was done, I sat down with a buddy of mine as a counselor, and I said, so how'd I do? And he goes, well, if your purpose was to shame everyone, you did a really good job. I said, okay, help me rewrite the sermon for the second service. I want to do that. But so often, we nibble and sip on God. We have our favorite sins. We have our favorite times of the day and night. Our people nibble and sip on God. They have their favorite times of day and night. They have their patchwork quilt. The little tract that Billy Graham used to hand out was Roger, his My House, His Home. Is that what it was called? Robert Munger? Is he the guy who wrote it? And it talks about after you become a Christian, the Spirit starts walking through your house and you shut a door and go, no, that's none of your business. Spirit says, actually it is. And it's this very powerful track about us opening all the doors in our house to make everything his home.
It's a video
now. It's a video now. Really? Oh, I got to get that because I love the imagery. I love the imagery. The blessing is on people who make Jesus the all-encompassing passion of their life. Hunger and thirst for Christ. Seek first the kingdom of God, and all these things will be added unto you. This is to balance that, though. Let me balance it. I had our elders read through Piper's Desiring God, Meditations of a Christian Hedonist. You familiar with it? It's his main book. He jokes that every book he writes is just a rewrite of that. Have you seen Don't Waste Your Life? Have you read that yet? Don't Waste Your Life? Okay, that's the best Piper book there is. We used to give it out to everyone graduating at any stage of their life. It's an easy read. High school students can do it. And it's just a plea to make God the all-encompassing passion of their life. And don't waste their life trying to make a lot of money or gain a lot of influence and power. It's Christ, it is a plea to hunger and thirst for righteousness. Really, really good book. I want to be careful, though, because I think it's chapter 4 is the chapter we struggled with, because Piper's defining salvation as those who love him more than they love anything else. Which means we're all going to hell. Right? I mean, honestly, does anyone here love Jesus more than their spouse? I don't. I know I should. I know I'm growing. I know I'm learning. But I really love my wife. I really love my kids. And it would be hypocritical for me to say, oh, sure, I love Jesus more than Robin, Tyler, Gerson, and Hayden. I don't. Sorry. That's the already but not yet. And I think Jesus is so patient. And he's saying, you'll learn slowly but surely. I may have to allow pain in your life for you to figure some of this stuff out, but slowly but surely you will learn that I am more desirable than Robin. And I may not know that till heaven, but it's a learning, it's a growing process. So the blessing is pronounced on those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. I don't think it means that we have to have arrived at the final state of Jesus truly being our all-encompassing passion above anything and everything else. Because then none of us are blessed. But it's a process, isn't it? And aren't you glad it's a process? Aren't you glad that we are learning to enjoy, to taste and see that He is good, and in ever new ways and in ever deepening ways? And again, let me urge, Jesus is so unbelievably patient, isn't he? He's so patient. And he nurtures us and he guides us through this process. And he's okay. I think he's okay being in second place for a while. We'll learn. We'll keep learning. Already, but not yet. The key to understanding all of this. Imagery is really strong, isn't it? Especially in an agrarian society where you worked all day and you got enough money to feed your family that night. Bread's important. In a desert climate, food's essential. So Jesus uses hunger and thirst, food and drink, to really drive the point home. And the promise is for those who, I wrote here, who are consumed. Let's be fair. For those who are becoming consumed with the things of God. Is that a fair way to say it? You didn't know what to do with that comment of mine, did you? Yeah. The promise for those who are becoming consumed with an all-encompassing passion for the things of God. The promise is they will be satisfied. We were satisfied at conversion, that as we let go the things of this earth and are consumed more and more with the things of God, we are satisfied. But ultimately, only in heaven, I think, will the words, "I am the bread of life, whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall never thirst." That's the process that's completed in heaven. We're learning it, we're growing in it, we're rejoicing in it. It's always out of our reach, but that's okay, because the process is a good process. Someday it will be. Piper says, "We are too easily satisfied. We are made for God, and yet we settle so often for less. And so many of our passions are for the things of this world that never truly satisfy." Okay. Anything you want to say? The metaphor that I settled on is that life is a journey. It's what I preached on at commencement. It's one of the reasons I joined the NIV is to get some of these metaphors of the walk back into it. Earlier, I think it was the TNIV, got rid of some of the metaphors of walking, and they're back in the 2011. I think the idea that we are on a journey, it has a starting point, it's the gate, we're traveling the path, and we're headed towards life, is a really, really powerful image. And it's one that I'm not sure the churches fully understand, that life is a journey, it's a process. And we talk about forgiveness. I'm going to tell you a story about a man who, a drunk driver, killed 3 members of his family and helped me understand what forgiveness is. But even something like forgiveness is a process. We are always learning how to forgive, aren't we? None of us, only one person ever just forgave, and he was hanging on a cross. We have to learn how to, we have to want to learn how to forgive, and then we need to learn how to forgive. And then when we forgive, we need to really mean it. And as we go through the motions, all of a sudden you realize one day, I really do mean this. I do want to forgive. Okay, and I'm going to expand that more later. But it's life is a journey. It is a process. And Jesus is so patient with us, helping us to learn gradually, slowly, surely learn. I'm actually working on a book. I started it 5 years ago, and then we went through a series of experiences that I wasn't at a point spiritually where I could keep working on it, but I'm going to pick it back up this summer and finish it. It's called The Path, and it's a story of 13 hikes in the Pacific Northwest, and it's an exposition of the gate, the path, and life. And I was going to call it Life as a Journey, but then we ended up using that for the title of one of the classes in biblical training, so had to shift it. But that's how much I believe in this cycle that I'm talking about. The book is about how, as we travel the journey, we learn. And then we learn it again. And then we learn it again in ever-deepening cycles. And it's a journey of grace. It's not a legalistic bunch of do's and don'ts, but it's something we're just learning and going with. And so that's how I understand all the Beatitudes. It's who we are, it's who we are becoming, and it's who eventually we will be. That's my understanding of Jesus' ethic. He's not someone somewhere terribly afraid that someone's having a bad time. So he doesn't give us a bunch of things that we can't do to make us miserable. But he walks with us on this journey. Poverty, mourning, meekness, hunger. This is how he works with us. Okay, all right. Well, we are through 4 of the 8. That's pretty good. And so we're actually kind of on track. Let's take a break, and we're going to go to lunch. And then we come back at 1:30. Daryl, is that right? Okay, so we'll see you back at 1:30, and we'll finish up the Beatitudes. Thanks.
This is Dr. Bill Mounts in his teaching on the Sermon on the Mount. This is session number 2, Beatitudes, part 2.